Good evening and welcome to tonight's Audubon Priority Birds Report Q&A call with National Audubon Society. My name is Chaney Sims and I will be the moderator for tonight's event. We are so excited to welcome our speakers and members of Audubon's National Science Team, Vice President and Chief Scientist, Dr. Chad Wilsey, and Director of Quantitative Science, Dr. Nicole Michael, for an in-depth conversation about Audubon's priority birds. Right now, we are in the process of dialing out to thousands of people, so just stay on the line and we'll be hearing from our speakers very soon. If you've just joined us, good evening and welcome to tonight's Audubon Priority Birds Report Q&A call with the National Audubon Society. My name is Chaney Sims and I will be the moderator for tonight's event. We can't wait to start our in-depth conversation about Audubon's priority birds. We'll be joined by Vice President and Chief Scientist, Dr. Chad Wilsey, and Director of Quantitative Science, Dr. Nicole Michael. We will begin in just a moment and are so excited to have you join us tonight. Right now, we're in the process of dialing out to thousands of members all over the country, so just stay on the line and we'll be hearing from our speakers very soon. If you've just joined us, good evening and welcome to tonight's Audubon Priority Birds Report Q&A call with the National Audubon Society. My name is Chaney Sims and I will be the moderator for tonight's event. We can't wait to start our in-depth conversation about Audubon's priority birds. We'll be joined by Vice President and Chief Scientist, Dr. Chad Wilsey, and Director of Quantitative Science, Dr. Nicole Michael. We'll begin in just a moment and are excited to have you join us tonight. Right now, we're in the process of dialing out to thousands of people, so just stay on the line and you'll be hearing from our speakers shortly. And now, without further delay, I'd like to introduce you to our first speaker, Chad Wilsey. Chad, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Chaney. Well, I'm very excited to be here this evening. As you said, my name is Chad Wilsey, and I live in Berkeley, California, with my daughter and wife. And just thinking about something relevant for tonight's call, one of my favorite birds is a species that I've seen just recently arriving in the Bay Area, the burrowing owl. We have a pair that have set up residence in some of the grasslands just about a mile away from my house, right next to San Francisco Bay. And I just love that juxtaposition of the city and the burrowing owls that travel between here and the Great Plains of Wyoming and other spaces throughout the year. I've been a birder for all of my adult life. I started birding in Costa Rica, actually, where I was working as a teacher. And some of the first birds, my spark birds, are actually migrants, neotropical migrants that I identified and saw for the first time in Costa Rica on their wintering grounds, wood thrush and the black and white warbler were two species I remember as being kind of spark birds for me. And, you know, I actually knew about Audubon well before I joined the organization. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, about a mile away from the Schlitz Audubon Center. And this was a place that my family and I, when I was growing up, would go to for walks on the nature trail and to hang out on the shores of Lake Michigan. For me professionally, I have had kind of a long path to where I am now as Audubon's chief scientist. My first career after completing a bachelor's degree in biology was to be a teacher, and I taught science and math for 3 years. Then I went back to school for a master's degree and got a job as a wildlife biologist doing surveys of birds in areas that were being proposed for energy development. And then I went back and got another degree, a PhD, where I focused on climate change. And that's really what brought me to the National Audubon Society 8 years ago, when I first started. And I've been working here primarily on some of our major climate reports, the Survival by Degrees report that came out in 2019, and previous to that, a report that came out in 2014, our Birds and Climate Change report. And it's only been in the last 2 years that I've been in the role of Audubon's chief scientist. And so that's a little bit of background on me, Janie.
Well, thank you for sharing. For everybody that joined us or is just joining us on the call, that was Dr. Chad Wilsey talking about how he got started at Audubon and his favorite bird, which was the burring owl. Love that. I'm also going to take a moment to introduce Nicole Michael, who's also on the phone with us, who's the Director of Quantitative Science here at Audubon. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself as well, Nicole?
Yes, hi, Chani, and hi, Chad. It's so good to be here today. Thank you for the invite to join you. Boy, picking a favorite bird is a really tough one, but I typically have to go with the common raven. They're just such beautiful birds and intelligent and playful, and most of all, they get to soar over some of the most beautiful country. I live in the Northwest, Portland, Oregon, with my wife and stepchild. And I grew up here in the Pacific Northwest and was actually my grandfather who first got me into birds. When I was very young, he was really into birds, maintained a lot of bird feeders. He told me about the swallows and how they come back to San Juan Capistrano every year, which I just was fascinated with. He even taught me how to feed chickadees out of my hand, which was just the coolest thing. And I actually identified my very first bird, a very thrush, from an Audubon field guide, and so I was hooked. When I, you know, got out of school and discovered that you could work as a field biologist, one of my first jobs was at Audubon's Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary in Florida. And then I worked for a different bird conservation nonprofit for a number of years and went back to graduate school, studied birds actually down in Costa Rica as well, and then did a postdoc up in Canada where I'd really gotten into modeling data analysis. And one day I happened to get an invite to review a paper that was written by a quantitative ecologist at National Audubon Society. And I literally like jumped up and ran to my friend's office and was like, I really want this job. And a month later, he moved on. Chad interviewed me. I got the position. And I've been with Audubon for 6 years now, Director of Quantitative Science for the last year.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much, Nicole. I'm always so fascinated by people's journey to Audubon, especially as somebody who's new to birding. I grew up in New York City and didn't start bird watching until my parents moved upstate and had a yard to not only plant a garden, but also have bird feeders. And every morning, my mother wakes up to see what new or returning visitors she has. It was actually one of the ways that we connected during the pandemic. I would call her every day and she would tell me about all the birds that she saw in the backyard. Cardinals are a favorite to spot, that flash of red in the trees and following them throughout the yard is thrilling, and we often hear woodpeckers as well early in the morning. Well, I just want to say on behalf of everyone on the call, thank you both for the important work that you do, not only to help ensure that birds can thrive, but also to make sure we understand what we can do to ensure a safer future for them, for habitats, and for our planet. Now, I actually have a question for all the members on the phone. We're going to have our first polling question of the evening because we want to hear from you as well. So if you could please use your keypad on your phone to answer the following question. Are you familiar with Audubon's Priority Birds Report? Please press 1 if you've read Audubon's Priority Bird Report. Press 2 if you've heard of Audubon's Priority Bird Report. And press 3 if you've never heard of Audubon's Priority Bird Report. I'm going to repeat the question and the options again. Please use your keypad on the phone to answer the following question. Are you familiar with Audubon's Priority Birds Report? Press 1. Press 2 if you've heard of Audubon's Priority Birds Report. And press 3 if you've never heard of Audubon's Priority Bird Report. We're going to take a moment to tally all of the results. And it looks like the vast majority of everybody on the call has heard of the Audubon Priority Birds report. Now that we've learned a bit about who we have on the phone, we'll hear firsthand from our Audubon Priority Birds report, about our Audubon's Priority Report, excuse me, from our science team, who helped author this important report, which was released at the beginning of 2021. Chad and Nicole, can you give us a little bit of a Priority Birds 101? What exactly is an Audubon Priority Bird?
The priority birds that we feature in this report are species of conservation concern that are going to benefit most from Audubon's conservation work. They include species that are representing a range of different habitats that we work in across the Americas, and also include year-round residents, neotropical migrants, and everything in between, Jamie.
Wonderful. And actually, one of the questions that we have the most from our members on the phone is, what criteria and methodology was used to discern an Audubon priority bird?
Yeah, great question. So it really varies. You know, there were a couple different criteria that we included, including first, you know, focusing on species that are species of concern. These might be species that are listed as endangered or threatened at the state or federal level, or that are listed as species of concern. But also, we wanted to focus on species that we work on, where we actually have the opportunity to make a difference with the actions that we take. And so these lists were determined separately for each strategy, initiative, and program.
Wonderful. And actually, I'm curious, how many priority birds are there?
We included 61 species in this report, and I just want to say that, you know, many of these species overlap with, you know, other priority bird species lists, such as birds of conservation concern that were produced by government agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service. And really, this is meant to be a living list that might evolve in the future as our strategies change and, you know, our areas of emphasis change. And so this is a snapshot in terms of how we're doing right now with the species that we've been focusing on. How effective are we being, and what has happened for those species?
Can you talk a little bit about what prompted the research as well?
Yeah, you hear so much about the sense of urgency. You know, we've learned recently about the loss of 3 billion birds across North America since 1970. And so we wanted to convey that sense of urgency, the need to protect the birds that Audubon and our members care about. But we also wanted to give a sense of hope. You know, it's easy to feel lost, you know, sometimes. And we wanted to convey, you know, to our membership that, you know, the donations they're making, the actions they're taking, and that our organization is taking, is really making a difference. That we're, this has been said, you know, what hope looks like for a bird. So what difference have we made for birds, their habitats, and their communities?
Yeah, you know, when I read the report, that's one of the things that I loved, is detailing of all the different strategies and initiatives that Audubon is undertaking. Can you actually talk a little bit about all of the different sections and some of the strategies and initiatives that are helping advance not only all the work and conservation work you all are doing, but helping to protect our priority birds?
Absolutely. Yeah, so when we look at all of our priority birds and across all of our different strategies, we see that we've lost a total of 165 million birds since 1970. When you look at that as a proportion of population, that's 35% of the birds that, you know, we or our parents or grandparents saw back in 1970. Across our strategies and initiatives, we lost the most birds, 159 million in the Working Lands Program. And coasts had the largest proportional losses, with a 47% loss. And Chad, you want to tell us more about coasts?
Yeah, so as you said, 47% of coastal priority birds have been lost since 1970. These results are consistent with a study that came out also in 2019, looking across all species, where we've seen almost 3 billion birds lost since 1970. So we're really just kind of narrowing in and focusing that that broader picture on the priority birds for Audubon. In the coastal habitats, we're really working to reduce the threats of habitat loss and degradation, of human disturbance, and of climate change. And the report includes, for all of these strategies, some examples of the ways that Audubon is making a difference. And so for the coastal strategy, we highlight some work that was done in San Francisco Bay, again, close to where I live, a project called Sonoma Creek, where they have restored a section of the street of the creek by actually connecting it to the bay to allow a free flow of water into the marsh and out back into the bay. And this allows the bay to drain properly and limits the amount of pooling of water that goes on. And because that pooling can break down the salt marsh habitat and lead to its overall degradation. And so they've increased this this flow of water, and that has actually resulted in a species of high conservation concern, ridgeway grail, to return to that habitat. And so it's a great example of how we've increased climate change resiliency and improved habitat quality in San Francisco Bay. Another example from coasts is some of the coastal stewardship work that has been going on for many years in Florida, and that program has had tremendous success increasing populations of least terns by stewarding and creating safe nesting areas for that species, and this has resulted in net increases over time of those bird species.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that in a moment, but you know, first I want to talk a little bit about our water strategy. So in water, we found that we've lost nearly 50 million birds. It's almost a quarter of the birds that were around in 1970. Some of these greatest losses have been in western water, you know, the Great Salt Lake and other interior saline lakes, as well as in the Delaware River back east. And, you know, these birds are facing so many threats like water quality and quantity, and as well as wetland loss and degradation. But Audubon has had some real successes with our policy and our wetland restoration efforts. Calumet Wetlands, one of the first projects I worked on when I started at Audubon, they've been restoring that habitat and these wetlands just outside Chicago, and we've seen, you know, rare birds like least bitterns and common gallinules return. And then in Florida, near where I worked at Corkscrew years ago, you know, back then in the 90s, snail kites were pretty rare, and they have really recovered thanks in part to Audubon's work and an introduction of an apple snail. But now working lands, though, Chad, that's a bit tougher over there, huh?
Yes. As Nicole mentioned earlier, the priority birds for working lands represent the group with the greatest losses. 159 million individuals since 1970 have been lost, and that's 37% of those priority birds and their total populations. We know that working lands are under tremendous pressure from habitat conversion to different land uses, agriculture, urbanization, energy. We're also seeing degradation of habitats due to diversion of water away from these working lands. And so this has really been a major priority for Audubon, and we have a number of programs that are really taking off, and they have had a tremendous amount of success focusing on habitat restoration, policy, addressing things like invasive species. Just to mention a couple of programs that have, that I've had some contact with that have been particularly successful. Audubon's Conservation Ranching Initiative, which is some work that we're doing engaging with ranchers throughout the West. This program exists in 11 states, working with cattle ranchers to help them develop habitat management plans that are friendly for birds, bird-friendly management practices that will improve bird populations over time. This program is encompassing 2.3 million acres right now. It's been growing steadily for the last 4 years. And we've already seen results, a 5 times increase in eastern meadowlark and a 6 times increase in northern bobwhite in Missouri, for example. And so there's lots of excitement around this program. It's growing, and you can actually look for some of the products that have this Audubon Conservation Ranching label. It's a certification, actually, grazed on bird-friendly land. You can find these products in grocery stores in some places, and then also online. There's online vendors that are give you the opportunity to purchase this beef, which, again, is grown on bird-friendly land. Another example of working lands is from California, a project that I helped out with a few years ago, which has been to work with ranchers who are growing wheat and to help them actually, this is a partnership actually with NRD, with the NRCS, excuse me, and they're working with ranchers to help them delay the harvest of their wheat when we find large colonies of tricolored blackbirds that are nesting in their fields. And so obviously there's a financial loss, so there's some payments involved with this delayed harvest. And the tricolored blackbirds are in a threatened species in California. They're an endemic species to California and parts of Oregon and in Mexico. And so it's a species of high conservation concern. And so just in the last year, they've been able to protect over 650,000 tricolored blackbirds. So working lands, again, is a landscape that has a lot of threats, and we've seen tremendous losses, but there are success stories, and Audubon has had a few of those through our programs. And Nicole, you're going to talk about COAST again.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, this is a fantastic example of success that we've had. So Audubon has had a coastal stewardship program that has been, you know, in action for a number of years across all of our coasts across North America. And my team put together a peer-reviewed study earlier this year that was published, in which we looked at 12 of our coastal priority bird species at nearly 400 sites where, you know, Audubon members and volunteers just like you have been, you know, participating and contributing your time to help protect birds that are breeding or, you know, roosting or wintering on beaches to reduce human disturbance. And we compared trends using eBird data at these sites where the birds are stewarded versus protected and unprotected areas. Found over that 3/4 of the species were more abundant or their populations grew faster where, you know, coastal stewards were out there working to reduce disturbance. And for 4 species, including piping plover, one of my favorites, populations grew 2 to 34 times faster where coastal stewards were out there than even at protected areas. So the, you know, the work that we're all doing is just really making a difference for our birds.
I love to hear that because, yeah, when you use some of those numbers, especially how many birds that we've lost, it kind of takes my breath away. But to hear all the successes that we've had through all these programs and in our communities, it's just wonderful. So thank you all so much for the work that you do. And thanks for everybody on the phone for all of your support and helping make it happen. And one of the things that I also found that was really interesting about the report is everything that we can do inside of our communities as well in creating bird-friendly communities. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what we can do in our communities and backyards?
Yes. So one of the strategies that was featured in the report is our bird-friendly community strategy. And much like the other examples we've shared, we have lost 52 million birds from the priority species that are featured in the report. That's about 26%. And we're seeing the greatest losses among forest generalist birds. So species like the yellow warbler, which lost actually 30 million individuals. And there are a number of things that you can do and a number of programs that Audubon has been advancing in urban contexts. One of those is focusing on bird-safe buildings and reducing building collisions, which is a significant and has been in the news lately, right? Some events in New York City most recently, and I believe there was an incident down in Texas a few months ago. And so these types of events are avoidable by turning lights off at night on large buildings in urban areas, also installing bird-friendly glass products. And one of the recent successes has been a new bird-friendly building code in New York City. So that's an example of how our bird-friendly communities program has been trying to address some of these threats. And then there's other programs such as in North Carolina, they've installed over 12,000, they've been installing nest boxes, which have led to population growth among the brown-headed nuthatch population in that region, which is an endemic species to the southeastern U.S. And so things like making our buildings safe for migratory birds at night and installing nest boxes are two examples of ways that you can help birds in urban habitats.
Thank you for that, Chad. I also am very interested in the work that we're doing to create community and more inclusive communities for birders. Can you talk a little bit more as well as about some of that inclusion and diversity work?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, so Audubon is really committed to equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging. You know, birding is an activity in which everybody should feel welcome. We all should feel a part of this community of people who enjoy birds. And so there are a number of great programs that have, you know, started up over the last few years. Let's Go Birding Together as a group are people of all gender identities and orientations will get together to go out birding. Birdability, I heard, was actually just recently mentioned in a New York Times newsletter, our program where people are updating web maps and information to show where people with different disabilities can access, you know, birding locations. And a program I'm really excited about is Forest Her, which is a program down in the Carolinas where Audubon has worked with partners to train over 700 women of diverse racial identity and age in fundamental forestry skills to, you know, help bring more women into this field that has been predominantly male-dominated in the past. So we're really, really making birding more welcoming.
I love that. And thank you so much for sharing about all the different sections of the Audubon's Priority Birds report. Now I just want to take a moment to get some insight from our members on the phone, and we're going to ask our second polling question of the evening. So members on the phone, please use your keypad on your phone to answer the following question. What main action do you currently take or hope to take to help protect priority birds? Press 1 if you plant native plants in your garden or in your community. Press 2 if you volunteer to help protect coasts or shorelines. Press 3 if you take action by voting for bird-friendly legislation and leaders. I'm going to repeat the question and the options once more. Please use your keypad on your phone to answer the following question. What main action do you currently take or hope to take to help protect priority birds? Press 1 if you plant native plants in your garden or in your community. Press 2 if you volunteer to help protect coasts and shorelines. And press 3 if you take action by voting for bird-friendly legislation and leaders. We're going to take a moment to tally up all of the results. Thank you all so much for participating and letting us know what you're doing to help protect priority birds, especially in your community. And it looks like over half of you plant native plants in your garden in your community, and another half are taking action by voting for bird-friendly legislation and leaders. You know, one of the other questions that we got from a lot of our members who are on the phone is about climate and priority birds. Now, Chad, I know that that's your expertise. Would you mind talking a little bit more about that?
Yeah, thank you. And I was excited to see that this was an area that the group was interested in. As I mentioned in the beginning, I've been working on our climate science since 2013. And, you know, I think this is one of the unique things that Audubon is bringing to this conversation. I think I can be as bold as to say that Audubon as an organization is really out in front defining the threat of climate change to birds and talking about the solutions and the importance of treating climate change as, you know, an existential threat to birds and to our planet. We, as I mentioned, released our Survival by Degrees report in 2019, and that identified 389 species, nearly two-thirds of bird species in North America, as vulnerable to climate change under a three-degree warming scenario, which is the path that we are on, or actually a little bit warmer than that, according to the Paris Accord. Now, we've all, many of you, I imagine, have heard in the news lately about COP26, which just happened in Scotland, and there are now new commitments that have us on a path of, again, if we can achieve those commitments, have us on a path that's slightly lower than this, down around 2.6 degrees of warming. But either of those paths really still leaves a majority of our birds at risk from climate change. And one of the key take-home messages of the report is that if we can actually keep warming to at or below 1.5 degrees Celsius, this is an average temperature of warming across the planet, then we can help 76% of those 389 species. So we can drastically reduce the overall risk of climate change to birds if we can keep warming below 1.5 degree average increase across the globe. Looking at individual groups of birds, some of the groups that are most vulnerable to climate change include birds found in the Arctic, also forest birds, coastal and water birds, and grassland birds. Those groups in particular had high proportions of species that were vulnerable to climate change. If we put this in the context of the Priority Birds report, we find that the priority birds for our bird-friendly communities program had the highest proportion vulnerable to climate change, 85%, followed by working lands, which was 70%, and the water strategy and the coastal strategies followed that up. Water at about 56% and coast at about 44%. So even within these priority birds, there's a relatively high proportion that are at risk from climate change. And so, you know, what can we really do to try to keep warming to at or below 1.5 degrees Celsius average increase across the planet? And we can, on the one hand, support policies that reduce carbon pollution. So support action from our decision makers, from our representatives to address climate change. But in addition to that, we can actually think about conservation as having a role to play, because the habitats that we want to protect can also capture carbon from the atmosphere and sequester it or trap it in their tissues and in their roots and in the soils as they decompose. And this is actually the focus of another report that just came out this spring, which is our Natural Climate Solutions report. And so this is a body of work that kind of looks for how we can use natural habitats as a means to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we're emitting into the atmosphere and to, you know, capture and permanently sequester that that carbon so that it doesn't result in warming. So I want to share some of the highline messages from this Natural Climate Solutions report, again, that just came out this spring. We estimate that the so what we did in the report was to map out areas that were important for birds, for bird conservation under a changing climate. We call those climate strongholds, and also to map out areas that are really important for carbon sequestration, and basically to see where those places overlap. So where can we get a benefit for bird conservation, and we have a high ability to capture carbon. And when we look across all those places and add up the potential, we actually find that these priority places to conserve and restore could address 23% of the U.S. commitment to draw down greenhouse gas emissions. And so these natural climate solutions really represent a significant part of the climate solution. 67% of these places are on private land. So this just reemphasizes, as we've already mentioned, the importance of programs that we have at Audubon, such as the Conservation Ranching Initiative I mentioned earlier, that are partnering with private landowners to help them have land management practices that are helping birds and, in this case, capturing carbon. And then looking across different habitats, we estimated that forests represent the greatest total amount of carbon that we could remove from the atmosphere. Just because of the extent of forests, they're so extensive across the continent. And then coasts, even though they're just a narrow fringe along the edge of the coastline, they actually have the highest potential to capture carbon per acre. And so that really reinforces our work in coastal environments to be getting the biggest bang for our buck. So climate change is definitely a major priority for Audubon. The species that we focus on in the Priority Birds report are threatened by climate change, a majority of those species. And we think that conservation really represents a natural solution to climate change because the habitats that we're trying to conserve to protect these birds can also remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sequester it in a permanent way.
Yeah, I really, that win-win is wonderful. And I just wanted to take a moment to actually ask some questions specifically from our donors who are on the phone. The first question is, to what degree is sea level rise being considered as a threat to shorebirds like the piping plover and other beach nesters? And do you have strategies for adaptation or to otherwise minimize that threat?
Yeah, absolutely. So sea level rise, we know, is a serious threat for, you know, our coastal breeding and wintering birds. And we are implementing a number of strategies to minimize that threat. There's a great example in our Gulf Restoration Plan, which came out a couple years ago now. And we talked about Elmer's Island. This is a beach in Louisiana, just a couple hours south of New Orleans. And some restoration efforts were conducted there where they actually added sand in order to build up the beach to a little bit higher elevation. And what this did is it increased hatching rates of leaf terns, which are quite vulnerable in the Gulf region. Unfortunately, with increased hatching rates came predators, but by adding fencing to protect the nest, we were able to reduce predation, keep those hatch success rates up. And then, long about midsummer, a tropical storm came along, wiped out leaf tern nests all across the Gulf. But those nests on this elevated beach at Elmer's Island were able to make it through. And Chad, you were talking about Sonoma Creek there near you. Can you tell us more about what they're doing there?
Yeah, so I did kind of go into a lot of depth already about Sonoma Creek, just creating that natural connectivity so that the water can flow from the bay. This is a creek in the San Francisco Bay, up into the marsh, and that the marsh can drain effectively. That is has been a tremendous success out here in California. A similar approach is being used in Farm Creek Marsh in Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. And they have, again, created a channel that is helping that marsh effectively drain And so this limits the amount of pooling of water. Anywhere that the water pools, you get the vegetation dies off, and it leads to marsh decline and essentially marsh loss. And so having effective movement of water in and out of the marsh is a real important resilience strategy. Another thing they've done at Farm Creek is similar to Elmer's Island, where they've deposited soil or compost on top of the marsh to raise its elevation. And this, again, just makes it more resilient over time to sea level rise. I also wanted to mention, all of those are examples of on-the-ground work that we're doing. We're also working kind of in the policy realm to address coastal vulnerability to sea level rise. And this is through supporting the Coastal Barrier Resources Act, which is actually probably not very well known act to most people, but is really important for coastal conservation. It actually says that it designates areas that are currently undeveloped that are not eligible to receive any federal dollars to be developed in the future. And this is a kind of a market-based incentive to not develop these areas, saves the federal government money, and also ultimately protects these coastal habitats. And that means that they can function to provide kind of resistance to sea level rise and storm surge during hurricanes. A lot of these areas are on the Atlantic seaboard. And so this Coastal Barriers Resource Act is something that we have been advocating to expand moving forward to, again, increase the amount of areas that are remaining protected and providing this coastal resilience function.
Well, thank you so much, Chad and Nicole, for reflecting and answering our donor question about changing climate and what it means for our priority birds and for our coast as well. For everyone on the call, I just want to say thank you all so much for submitting your questions. We worked really hard to ensure that many of your questions got answered, but we couldn't answer them all. We're going to get to a few more, but I actually wanted to take a moment to talk about a section of the report that we haven't just yet, and that's the Migratory Bird Initiative. Can you speak a little bit more about that and let us know anything that you can share about some of the things that are coming up around that?
Sure, Jamie, I can take that question. The Migratory Bird Initiative is a really exciting new program at Audubon. Our vision for the program is to secure the future of migratory birds in the Western Hemisphere by identifying the places that these birds need to thrive across the Americas, taking actions to protect the places that these birds need, and to reduce the threats, and to do all of this by engaging people from communities of diverse backgrounds in the joy that is migration. And this is really capturing, you know, an effort by Audubon to think about birds throughout their full annual cycle. Migratory birds spend more than half of the year outside of the United States or outside of the U.S. and Canada. And so we really need strategies, conservation strategies, that have this hemispheric perspective. And so what we're doing with the Migratory Bird Initiative is assembling all the information that we can gain access to on the movements of birds throughout their annual cycle. And we've done this by assembling tracking data. So this is where you put individual devices on individual birds. These devices are then recording the journey of that bird throughout the year. We've done this for 131 species. Again, assembling this information. It's not that we've collected it ourselves, but we've reached out to over 200 different researchers and asked for them to share with us their tracking data. We have tracking data for over 5,000 individuals, and this represents over 9,000 different tracks. We've also looked at information that shows how places are connected by birds. A lot of this is banding data, so birds that were banded in one location, and then the bird band, a little ring that goes around their leg, is recovered in another or spotted in another. And so that gives us an idea of how two different places are connected by that bird. And so we actually have this banding data and connectivity data for 381 species that amounts to over 4 million connections. And then we've partnered with Cornell Lab of Ornithology to look at their eBird data and how they've used that to map bird movements every week of the year. And so by putting all this data together in the Migratory Bird Initiative, we now have an incredible tool to start informing our conservation work, informing our policy, informing the work of Audubon Americas that's working internationally in other countries to put on-the-ground conservation into action, to inform our field offices in states across the U.S. and centers and sanctuaries and even our chapters, to give them a tool that will help them understand the movements of birds throughout the year and to understand how they're connected to these faraway places by birds. And so that a conservation issue in a place as faraway as Alaska actually might be relevant to the birds that you're seeing in your backyard. And that's what the Migratory Bird Initiative is doing. It's really making those connections and helping communicate that to people so they kind of understand kind of the joy and magic of migration and how you know, their birds are connecting them to these faraway places. So you will be hearing more about this initiative in the future. We're working on a website that's going to be interactive and allow you to look up individual species and understand, again, these movements across the hemisphere and understand the threats, the conservation challenges that these species are confronting as they travel throughout the year and throughout the hemisphere. So that's, in a nutshell, our Migratory Bird Initiative and what we're trying to do, assemble data and use that data on bird movements to inform our conservation priorities across the hemisphere and really expand our sights to be thinking not just in the U.S., but across the Americas and trying to develop holistic strategies for conservation.
It's really exciting work, and I'm very excited about the Migratory Bird Initiative as well as the website. It's actually one of the questions that we received, so I'm glad that you got to talk about it. It was not only about migratory birds, but also any work that Audubon is doing with other organizations. So thank you so much for that, Chad. One of the other questions that we had from our members on the phone was, what are the things that we can do to help the birds in our backyard and in our communities? How can we become better advocates and allies for the birds that we love?
Yeah, there are so many things that you can do as individuals. So, you know, this ranges from using the power of your voice, you know, becoming an advocate. We have Find Your Flock advocacy webinars. You can go to act.audubon.org and learn more about how to become a better advocate for birds. Related to that, you can click on Take Action emails. Audubon regularly sends out emails to all of our members letting you know about issues that we encourage you to contact your representatives about in order to take action on an issue that will really impact birds. On the home front, you know, buying bird-friendly products. Chad mentioned the Conservation Ranching Program earlier. You can, at your store or your mail order programs, buy beef from cows that were raised on Audubon-certified bird-friendly land. We're also now selling bird-friendly coffee. I love it. I drink my bird-friendly coffee and other products. Chad, you want to talk about a few more?
Yeah, and I imagine many of you are already involved in local chapters, but a lot of the stewardship work that we have mentioned in the report as being success stories is led by our state field offices and chapters. And so joining a chapter and participating in their conservation work is a way that you can get involved and directly benefit birds, as this report shows and the study that Nicole shared in particular around coastal stewardship. We can actually say with confidence that this stewardship work that people are doing is benefiting birds. So that's an exciting one. In the science team, we manage a number of programs that you know, are open to the public. The Christmas Bird Count is an annual count conducted every December, and there are circles all across the U.S. and Canada, where you can sign up to participate in the count. It's a single day. You just go out in the morning, usually in a group, and count birds. And then usually there's a meetup in the afternoon to share the totals and sum them up across all the different groups that were out that day. Another program that's a little bit newer, Christmas Bird Count's been going on for over 121 years. A newer program is Climate Watch, which we just started about 5 years ago. And this is something that you can, again, sign up for online and go out two times a year. We have this program in the winter and in the summer, and look for specific species that we're using as a way to test some of our climate science. We're actually using this activity to see if the birds are moving in the way that we think they would in response to climate change. So that's an exciting project, and we've already got one scientific paper from that activity, again, showing that they are, in fact, responding to climate change. And then maybe the easiest one is just eBird. If you haven't used that tool before, it's from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, but it's an amazing app for your smartphone, or you can use it on your computer to record the checklist of birds that you've seen when you go out on bird walks. And those data are tremendously valuable. We're using those in a number of different ways to run scientific analyses to inform our conservation. And then two other programs to mention. A lot of you said that you plant native plants, so I'm guessing you're familiar with the Plants for Birds program, but this is an online tool that can help you identify native plants that are appropriate for where you live by typing in your zip code. And then Nicole mentioned signing up for the Find Your Flock advocacy trainings that are done by our advocacy team, which will help you become a better advocate for birds.
Thank you. One of the follow-up questions about what we can do. Our members are really concerned about the mysterious illness that affected songbirds this summer. Do you have any insights you can share on this, since it's of such great concern?
Yeah, that was a really puzzling illness. And, you know, I have to say that, based on my latest survey, scientists are still not totally sure what caused it. And so studies were done where they, scientists looked for, common parasites or illnesses, Salmonella, West Nile virus, avian influenza are things that we know affect birds and were not detected in any of these species. Early on, I heard a lot of talk about it being perhaps linked to cicadas. If you were, in parts of the eastern U.S., you may remember Brood X this year. While at first there seemed to be spatial overlap with the disease occurring where the Brood X cicadas were emerging, as the illness progressed, it was observed well outside that range. So at this point, we're still not sure if it was caused by a disease vector or by a toxic substance. But the illness did eventually stop on its own in late summer, and so all states have removed their do not feed orders. You're safe to put your feeders back up again, but it's always a good idea to keep your feeders clean.
Thank you, Nicole. And for everybody who's on the call, there's actually an article from September on Audubon.org about the East Songbird epidemic that has some more details and things that we can do, including how to keep our feeders clean to protect the songbirds. Well, we're getting to our last question of the evening. I just want to take a moment to circle back to the report and ask, what are three key things you learned from its findings that apply most profoundly to creating a safer future for birds?
Yeah, great question there, Cheney. So the pattern of bird declines that were highlighted in that recent study showing the 3 billion bird loss are echoed in our priority birds report. Although we looked at fewer species because we were just looking at priority birds, we saw the same overall pattern of decline across the priority birds across our focal strategies. And so this really shows us, as you said, three things. First, birds are facing a lot of really big and interlinked threats. Climate change, habitat loss and degradation, and pesticides, these things are happening all at once, and And that means we need to be mobilized to be able to work and address multiple fronts at once. And second, although many of these threats are, you know, hemispheric or even global, there's things you can do to make a difference right in your own backyard and in your community through relatively simple actions. And finally, we found that, you know, by working together on both the big things, you know, as well as the small local changes, we can demonstrably make a difference for birds, for their communities, and the people like us who love them.
Well, thank you so much, Chad and Nicole, for sharing all of your insights and your expertise. This has been an absolutely wonderful discussion, and I've learned so much. I'm sure our members on the phone have as well. Is there anything else you'd like to add or share before we sign off for the evening?
I just want to thank all of you. It's your membership and you know, contribution to this effort that is really helping us do all we can to protect birds. So thank you.
I echo Nicole's sentiment. Thank you for being part of the Audubon family. And hopefully when you see this report, you think about, you know, how some of these programs wouldn't have happened without that commitment, and in some cases, you know, some of the personal actions that many of you have taken out there, stewarding lands, trying to protect birds. We're actually demonstrating that that makes a difference. So thank you for that.
And I just want to take a moment to thank everybody on the call again. And on behalf of everybody, thank you both again for all of the work that you are doing for Audubon and for all of us and for all the birds that we love. Deeply appreciate all of it and you taking the time to speak with us tonight. I also wanted to mention, as Chad was talking about the Christmas bird count and our community bird science program, our 122nd Christmas bird count is going to be taking place on Tuesday, December 14th through Wednesday, January 5th. You can find out more about it on our website. It's going to be my first Christmas bird count, and I hope that everybody will join us. Well, once again, thank you all for joining us on our Audubon Priority Birds Q&A call. We deeply appreciate your outstanding support, your commitment to our critical conservation work, and all you do for birds. I just want to take a moment to wish you all a safe holiday season, and thank you again for joining our discussion. Wishing you all a wonderful evening. Thanks so much.